Hello, hello, hello. So what we're going to discuss today is the Soviet Union, kind of the economic policies from all the way from Lenin to Stalin to Khrushchev to Brezhnev and finally to Gorbachev, so that you can have that overview and that contrast of those policies over time in order to evaluate and analyse that change and continuity. So we're going to start off with Lenin, and obviously Lenin takes over, starts a revolution in October 1917, allowing the Bolsheviks to establish power and start to establish the communist regime. Obviously, one of the first things he does is the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, which pulls Russia out of the First World War. Now, this causes quite a lot of conflict, obviously, with your nationalists, so your people that want the restoration of the Tsar, and the people that are quite proud of kind of the military history of Russia, which starts the Russian Civil War from 1917 to about 1921. And during this time period, Lenin establishes his first kind of heavy economic policy, which is war communism. Now, arguably, with war communism, you could say it's not really an economic policy. You could say it's more of a focus on kind of political and consolidating power. Because what war communism did is it established, made sure that grain was requisitioned, so taken away, forcibly taken from kind of the workers and given to the Red Army. Now, the Red Army obviously needed food to maintain themselves in order to be strong enough to fight and defeat the White Army. So it requisitioned grain and essentially gave that power to the Bolsheviks. So obviously to help enforce this grain requisitioning, you've got the Cheka, so the secret police that are authorised to seize grain and other forms of food. You've got rationing as well. So your largest rations went to the workers and the soldiers, and your smallest rations are given to your bourgeoisie. Within war communism as well, you've got an extended working day, so up to 11 hours, and work is compulsory for everyone that is able-bodied between the ages of 16 and 50. And harsh punishments, again, given to workers who are late or were caught slacking. Again, to try and force and enable the Reds to win the Civil War. You've also got the abolition of kind of the market. Money no longer exists. He gets rid of money. So you've got this series of hyperinflation. Money becomes worthless, and therefore money just doesn't exist anymore. Private trade is made illegal, so you've got the start of those communist elements coming in. And you've got nationalisation, all businesses owned and taken over by the state. So it's a move towards that socialist society. That's what Lenin's argument is that move towards that socialist society. And it did succeed in enabling the Reds to win the Civil War, but it does lead to quite serious economic collapse, because you've got lower rates of agricultural production, your peasants aren't paid, and therefore they've got no incentive to really work. So your agricultural rates are lower, you've got lots of hunger, you've got famine, and your industrial workforce declining quite significantly, partially due to the war, but also to people escaping the cities, because obviously that's the stronghold for the war and establishing power, taking over the cities. And then within that, you also got obviously the rise of your black market. So about 60% of food during this time period starts to come from the black market. Obviously that in itself is an indication that the economy is not functioning properly, and again, mass poverty, famine. You've got what, around 6 million people suffering and dying as a result of famine. So with this economic crisis, it sort of starts to turn into something political, because within that you have got your Kronstadt mutiny. So 1917 to 1921, you've got all of this war communism going on. And in 1921, your sailors start to mutiny. And they go, right, we want to get rid of war communism. We want freedom. We want kind of that peace as well. So Lenin starts to realise, okay, I need to get rid of war communism now. It's achieved its goal. It's helped us to win the Civil War. Arguably, the murder of the Bolsheviks, the murder of the Romanovs contributes to that. But that's another story. So war communism leads to that military victory, Arguably, it's a bit of an ideological victory as well, because it obviously gets rid of money, nationalises things, and starts to go on that foundation for a socialist and communist society. But obviously, rebellions are a problem, because if you've got rebellions, you're not politically stable, because they're still in that early stages of obtaining power. So Lenin gets rid of this, and he introduces something in 1921 called the NEP, and that is the New Economic Policy. Now, our New Economic Policy goes a bit against those socialist and communist ideals they've just tried to establish. It's almost a step back and an economic retreat, with essentially a purpose to maintain political power. He wanted to revive the economy, so he needed something to stimulate that grain production and end the famine, and to try and build up socialism. And Lenin wants to do that without foreign aid. So he wants kind of a socialism to develop kind of worldwide. But in order to do that, he needs to build it up in Russia first without kind of foreign support. And he says, well, this is actually the correct way that we need to build build a socialist society. And he says, right, by using kind of capitalist methods, we can achieve communist goals, which is a little bit contradictory, but he tries it anyway. And it creates a mixed economy. So agricultural production is left to the free market, so people can buy, sell and produce freely, obviously make profits. Smaller factories are denationalised, so they're allowed to be privatised again. And again, money is reintroduced. So makes things a little bit easier in society. But the NEP obviously led to political and economic stability, but it didn't lead to that rapid industrial growth that the Soviet Union needed. So obviously ending grain requisitioning was very popular amongst the peasants. Remember, that's 80% of your population. Now he's able to kind of keep them calm, keep them on his side by abolishing war communism. It also obviously ends the famine, and it does lead to that industrial growth. So the market starts to get stimulated again. But we've also got within that uneven economic growth, and that's something called the scissor crisis. So think of what a pair of scissors looks like when it's open. You've got almost industrial growth going one way and agricultural growth going the other way. So with agricultural growth, that recovers quite quickly. So you've got greater food supplies, you've got a drop in agricultural prices, whereas your industry is a lot more slower. And so you get this gap between your farmers' incomes and your industrial prices. And essentially it reaches a crisis point when we get to 1923 or so. Farmers cannot afford to buy industrial goods, and therefore that reduces that incentive for farmers to keep producing large quantities of grain. So the government try and intervene, but then that means there's less money available to improve the economy. So under the NEP, they could not industrialise. It was impossible because that gap was so far apart. And it leads to that re-emergence of kind of inequality, increased corruption. And yeah, it's not very good for what they want to achieve. And as a result of the NEP, yes, you've got almost a little bit of stability, but then you start to see those factions emerging within the Communist Party itself. So Trotsky, Bukharin, Stalin, all kind of arguing about kind of the use of the NEP and how they're going to industrialise Soviet society. So obviously that's quite exciting, because you start to see that leadership struggle, that industrialisation debate within that. So you've got, within your party, it's almost split into those factions again. So you've got your left wing, so that's Trotsky. He favours a policy of forced agricultural collectivisation. That's important to remember when you look at what Stalin does, because collectivisation is not his idea. He takes it from Trotsky. So Trotsky says merging farms together would place them all under state control, allows profit to be generated quite quickly, enable you to industrialise quickly. Whereas on your other hand, on the right, you've got Bukharin, who says, well, actually, no, the NEP is the best way of industrialisation. Let's stick with that. It's slowly allowing economic growth. So industrialisation would happen eventually. Stalin at this point becomes a bit of a pragmatist. He sort of sticks in the middle until he starts to see, okay, the NEP is actually leading to economic decline. And then he starts to change his position towards the left. And this is where we start to see our five-year plans and that industrial change and almost a series of quite radical policies which do actually transform that Soviet economy. And they do help the Soviet Union to become that industrial giant and lay its foundations kind of for that war economy, victory over Germany in the Second World War. And it becomes quite essential to the Soviet system. So we start with the five-year plans, and Stalin introduces these five-year plans for quite a few reasons. His main objective is obviously to industrialise Russia. He wants to industrialise Russia because he thinks, well, you can't revolutionise the rest of the world and kind of help them to turn communist if you haven't industrialised Russia in the first place. He thinks, okay, the Soviet Union is about 100 years behind Britain and the USA, quite clearly, because remember, during this time period, if we look at, obviously, when the Tsar was in charge, Russia was pretty much on the levels of medieval society, medieval Britain, because it still got serfdom, peasants and that hierarchy. So Stalin tries to go, right, we're going to industrialise Britain, get 100 years, catch up. And he wanted to eliminate the inefficiencies of the NEP. And they thought, okay, if the government controlled production, it's going to make it much more efficient. And he says, well, these plans are necessary because it helps to develop new factories and revive that industry. And obviously within this, you can also see those Soviet kind of military concerns slash that military background that Russia's always had. Because Stalin's got that fear that Germany is going to invade the Soviet Union. Because remember, you've got the rise of Hitler during this period. So defending Soviet territory, they need that modern industry. And they need those weapons to be able to fight a modern war. Because remember, their loss of the First World War, they were so inequipped. They didn't have good leaders. They didn't have good enough equipment. So by introducing these five-year plans, they can be equipped to fight a war. They can industrialise. And also Stalin can assert his own authority. It's more ambitious than what Lenin ever did. And it demonstrates that Stalin is actually better at building this new phase of socialism. So initially, obviously between 28 and 41, you've got 3 5-year plans. And essentially, they all follow similar things and similar ideas. They were not necessarily strict. Essentially, it was just a list of targets that the workers needed to achieve, which was very, very heavily kind of pushed with propaganda. And the propaganda obviously pushes that this idea that these plans are going to make this modern industrial future, it's going to destroy capitalism, it's going to be successful, you're going to be a hero. So it's more of kind of a command economy. And this is what these five-year plans create, a command economy. So a command economy, think about what the words mean. So command, literally the government decide what is produced. If they want something produced, that is what is happening. That is what is produced. No more, no less. So those focus is very, very much on heavy industry and production of iron, steel, coal, oil and electricity. That is the main focus for those five-year plans. It's all about kind of building those new factories, utilising and exploiting the natural resources that Russia has. Because remember, Russia is very, very vast. There's a lot of land that could be utilised. And obviously, to get to this land, they need to improve the transport. So you start to see the development of the Moscow-Volga Canal, arguably slightly efficient, but we'll get to that later on. And obviously, you've got your Trans-Siberian Railway, making it easier to allow people to travel to work and allow goods to go around. And again, within this, though, you've got quite a few problems. Because you've got low productivity. Again, long hours, low pay, lack of incentives in the system. People don't necessarily want to work, and you've got a lot of people moving around different jobs to start with. And again, with this command economy as well, production quality is low because the focus is so heavy on the numbers. It's about the targets. It's all about this quantity over quality. And therefore, you're rewarded if you produce large amounts of goods. Doesn't matter if it's rubbish. Doesn't matter if it falls apart. If you're producing those numbers, you are meeting the targets of the plan, which obviously just causes more problems in the long term because you're having to keep producing those goods over and over again because they're not good enough quality. And obviously, things weren't utilised properly. So there's a lot of 40% of wasted goods. They're often disorganised. And obviously, during this time period, you've also got the purges and the terror, which doesn't really help the plans because you're getting rid of your key workers and the people that are running those plans and your factory managers. So attacking those officials doesn't really work it, and the plans are very, very much undermined by those unrealistic targets that are set. And obviously, falsified data, again. And because that priority is so much on heavy good and heavy industry, you've got a continued shortage of consumer goods. You've got no clothes, shoes, furniture. And that's just managed by rationing. So rather than dealing with the problem, they just ration things. So those social problems are not dealt with because the focus is so much on those heavy goods. Yes, you've got really, really kind of a significant amount of success in terms of rearmament and being prepared for war. But it's not prepared its people, and it's not helped and benefited the people. By not helping the people, not helping with consumer goods, you've got quite a low standard of living, really. Housing is a massive problem. Living conditions are really poor. Workers, well, alongside that, you've got really harsh working conditions, forced to work 7 days a week, long hours. If you were late, if you were absent, that became a criminal. You've also got those internal passports. Because workers just kept moving from town to town, you had those internal passports to stop them from moving, to make sure they stayed in an area so you keep your workers. And again, it keeps the black market going because of the inefficiencies of the plan. So yes, it becomes quite heavily industrialised and it becomes quite powerful, but it's so unbalanced because the whole focus has been on arms production. You've almost lost everything about the consumer and the consumer goods and your society and your people in society. Stalin decides, that Trotsky had some good ideas earlier. I'm going to do some collectivisation. So Stalin decides to collectivise the Soviet agriculture between kind of 1928 and 1941. So you could argue it's sort of part of those five-year plans. So collectivisation is just that process of getting all those small farms and collecting them and merging them into almost one large farm. So families between 150 or up to 150 families, all sharing those farm resources, and it's all been taken over by the state. It's this idea that, it's getting rid of those private properties, getting rid of that capitalistic element and bringing all the farms together, all nationalized, all belonging to the state. And they believe that a large farm would be more efficient than smaller farms, as you've got more expertise, equipment can be shared, and it would create a fairer and more efficient society, and would win over the peasants because it would abolish that private property. And obviously, with the failure of the NEP, it was quite easy to implement this idea. So farms are forcibly merged, equipment is taken from your richer peasants, sorry, from your kulaks, and given to the poorer peasants. And the rest was used, so the peasants who worked on the farms were allowed to keep little bits of grain, but then the rest was kind of sold into the cities to provide money to fund industrialisation. And collectivisation had... it was chaos. It was not efficient at all. So arguably, you've still kind of got this requisition of grain still going on. And the peasants respond to this simply by destroying their crops, animals and machinery, because they would rather destroy their farm than actually give it over to the government because it wasn't worth anything for them. And then this then leads to that destruction. You've got over 17 million horses, 26 million cattle kind of all killed off before anything can be kind of given to the government. And you've also got a massive decrease in grain production. So in 1928, they're producing 73.3 million tonnes. And when you get to 1934, this has decreased to 67.6 million tonnes. Largely, this is a result of, obviously, peasants keeping things for themselves or destroying things. We've also got something which is a little bit ridiculous if you look at what Stalin does. Obviously, you've got the purges and the terror going on. Stalin executes or deports kulaks. And those are often your most experienced and your most successful farmers. So by getting rid of them, it's almost getting rid of the people that are actually doing the work in society. And again, you've got that absence of initiatives as well. Farmers can't make a profit, so why should they bother? And something quite significant as well is this famine in Ukraine that this leads to, mass famine. So Ukrainian farmers start to resist collectivization, and Stalin deliberately punishes them by seizing grain and livestock. So this is almost your man-made famine, and it results in 5 million dead in Ukraine. And Stalin refuses to accept international offers of help. And he uses this famine to destroy that resistance of the Ukrainian farmers. So it's very, very serious what he does. And obviously during this time period, people aren't necessarily aware that Stalin has created this famine. And it's not kind of opened up about in the Soviet Union until a lot later on. So alongside that, you've got an attempt at mechanization, because remember, the way society is, you've got horses farming land. So they start to introduce, obviously, tractors. You've got 75,000 tractors, but this has very, very limited impact. And long term, it was just not successful. So collectivization was a massive failure economically, because there was nothing to gain from it for the people. And if they had nothing to gain, they don't want to work, and therefore you see your grain decrease. You've also got the government obviously taking a lot of grain from the peasants, so they're benefiting, and they're obviously able to export quite a lot out of the country. But at what cost? Because you're not providing for the people in your own country. So externally, it for those on the outside receiving those exports, it might look like the Soviet Union are being quite successful. But for those peasants and all those people at home, they are suffering quite significantly. Obviously, then you've got your post-war. Obviously, the Second World War led to a lot of devastation all over the world. It destroyed quite a lot of that Soviet economic process, the progress that they'd already made. You've got 25 million people that are homeless, and your industry is producing two-thirds less than it had prior to the war. So obviously, that fourth five-year plan in 1945... really focuses on that industrial growth, and you've got about 88% of the investment going again into heavy industry. So industrial output increases by 80%, and they're able to exceed that pre-war production rates, but they're still focusing on that military expenditure. So obviously for the Soviet Union and the USA, you've got the start of that Cold War, obviously as a result of those Potsdam Conference in 1945. So the Soviets kind of use that as a way to keep spending on the military, and that becomes almost a quarter of the government budget. And by focusing on the military, once again, there's less money available for other sectors of the economy. And it's almost mirroring exactly what happened under the Tsar, that the focus is still on being that military superpower and having that power, and not focusing on the social issues that are kind of prevalent in society. But they do start to produce a little bit more consumer goods, but that's only 12% of their investment. So there's still, again, the heavy focus, And in terms of reconstruction for housing, remember we've got 25 million homeless. They're focusing on the factories rather than the homes. They're neglecting those people once again. Wages are kept low. And there's a lot of insufficiencies with this plan itself. So yes, okay, these policies weren't successful in terms of the people, but they did meet Stalin's initial aim, which was to transfer the Soviet Union into an industrial giant, to grow the Soviet Union. And so it places everything under state control, because you've got the farming now under state control, and you've got that industrialization, that military superpower starting to rise. So yes, it wasn't necessarily successful in terms of keeping the people on the side, but that didn't matter under Stalin, because he would just purge anyone that opposed him. So in terms of success, you could say, well, yes, Stalin's quite successful because he meets his aims, but he also neglects kind of those social aspects. So you could argue perhaps his political power is quite weak, because people are trying to oppose in any way they can. And obviously this is more of a focus on the economy rather than politically, whereas with under Lenin the focus was more about consolidating power, whereas under Stalin it's about improving the economy and trying to industrialize. That was a little bit of waffle, wasn't it? And obviously then we go on to Khrushchev, and Khrushchev moves away from that heavy industry, which you'd think is initially going to be quite good, and perhaps he'll focus on the people, but no, he focuses on agriculture, and arguably, again, well, once again, a failure for the Soviet Union. He decides, okay, I think that Soviet agriculture is very inefficient, it's not very productive, so we need to reform it to increase productivity and create a better standard of living, and to revive that Soviet economy. So he introduces quite a few series of reforms and incentives to revive that agricultural sector.